could be used as a defense to say, well, notwithstanding the terms of our trust, we're not responsible for cleanup. You're responsible, I understand it, if you're there's liability if an act of omission causes or exacerbates the release of materials. But once, sort of, so to speak, once the toxic horse is out of the barn, your duties are end at that point. You're not responsible to get the horse back. So I know that's a long way and probably a very naive way of asking a question about trust law, but can you make any sense out of my question?
Mr. Chair, help me with that. Representative Edmondson, let me give it a try.
Okay.
First of all, you have to distinguish between the liability of a trustee in their fiduciary capacity to the trust, to the beneficiaries of the trust. Now, that is guided by state law and by the whatever the trust instrument says, okay? So let's say we have a situation where there is contaminated real property that is held in trust. What this law is intending to do is, except to the extent that that was caused by an act or omission of that trustee, exempt the trustee's personal assets. Like, if you're an attorney and acting as a trustee, the attorney's personal assets would be exempt, but not the trust assets. Okay? The trust assets, those, you know, those are free game and would probably, in most circumstances, remain fully liable for hazardous waste cleanup. Certainly not impacted by this act.
Okay, stop. Then, you know, XYZ Bank of Oregon is the trustee for the ABC Corporation.
Correct.
Okay. And acquires all the assets of the ABC Corporation through foreclosure of a note or something of that nature. Now, ABC Corporation has property that's been contaminated. Are you saying that all the assets of this ABC Corporation are available to be for cleanup,
Mr.
But,
Chair,
but not the XYZ Bank? Its assets are not available?
Representative Edmondson, let me ask a question. Are you referring to the bank in this circumstance as a trustee under a deed of trust?
Well, possibly. Fiduciary seems broad enough that they could have several, could become a fiduciary in several capacities.
Well, first of all, as a trustee under a deed of trust, you serve a very limited purpose, and that is part of the fiction that it's a three-party document. All you do is send out some notices, and generally you'd name a title company as a trustee, and if there's going to be foreclosure, you appoint a new trustee who is the lawyer that's going to do the foreclosure.
Okay.
So it would exempt them, yes,
okay.
Foreclosing trustee, because they didn't have anything to do with it.
Right. Okay.
Now, in your hypothetical, you said, trustee bank holds the assets of ABC Corporation in trust. Now, what that means to me is that the assets of ABC Corporation were put in trust by the shareholders, okay?
Right.
All the trustee does is manage the trust under fiduciary principles, you know, the prudent business rule and the purposes and intent of the trust. That may include a duty as between the trustee and those beneficiaries of the trust to act certain ways vis-a-vis contaminated property.
Okay.
This doesn't affect that.
Okay, that's the answer that I was getting at.
Okay.
If ABC comes to the bank and says, I want you to be the trustee of our property, we're going to create a trust and you're going to run it. And if this property is contaminated, you're going to agree, you clean it up. I've assumed that any prudent bank is going to do some survey to try to determine if they're going to have to clean up some dirty, if they're getting a dirty property with this. But that, if that's in the trust, this does not in any way
would not affect it, except that what it would do is it would allow the trustee to be able to fulfill those trust purposes with knowledge that they would not be held liable personally beyond trust assets, except to the the trustors on some okay. common law theory, but they would not be held liable to the state.
Or the neighbors?
Or the neighbors.
Unless there was gross negligence or intentional misconduct.
Right.
Recklessness.
Correct.
But Mr. Chair,
I knew there was a reason I never studied that stuff very hard.
But Mr. Chair, your example is very hypothetical, because chances are, without the passage of this act, no trust company in Oregon is going to be involved with ABC Corporation.
Yeah, you know, very hypotheticals like partially pregnant. So, Representative Brian, you've joined us. Do you want to jump into this trust? Toxic trust?
Certainly will okay. when I have questions,
All
Mr.
Right.
Chairman.
Okay.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes.
On page 3, lines 29 to 30, I understand how a lender can hold a facility pursuant to the terms of an extension of credit. How does a lender control or manage a facility pursuant to the terms of an extension of credit?
The intent there, learned counsel, is to get at the situation where during the pendency of a loan workout, during the pendency of foreclosure proceedings, something along those lines, that either the lender or a receiver selected by the lender or appointed by a court may have to keep a business up and running to maintain the going concern value of that business.
Thank you.
Was that your only question?
Yes.
Okay, further questions? Go ahead. Is that it?
Thank you very much.
No further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Williamson. Oops. Sorry. Would like to testify at the next hearing on this, if possible? I'm having a hard time reading your handwriting.
I've raised several concerns about this bill with Mr. Bronner. He would like me to talk to their counsel. I don't want to take the committee's time with things that may not be a problem. There are some things that probably will be a problem, but I'd like to at least narrow those.
Great. We appreciate that. Thank you. We will look forward to hearing from you next time around. Quincy Sugarman. This is our way of trying to keep witnesses on their toes. You never quite know who's the temporary chair. The gavel's kind of floating back and forth. So just guess and do the best you can. Alternate between saying Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, and you'll be all right.
Thank you. I perhaps should have been less generous in giving out extra copies of my testimony to the previous witnesses. I will be raising the many of the arguments that they mentioned that people would be raising. no big surprises. For the record, my name is Quincy Sugarman, and I'm an environmental advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. OSPRG is a statewide consumer and environmental research and advocacy organization with 30,000 members. I'm also a member of the Department of Environmental Quality's Environmental Cleanup Advisory Committee, which works on issues arising from the implementation of the state's Superfund law. And today I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 3349. In the 1987 legislature, OSPRG advocated for a strong state Superfund law to protect public health, safety, welfare, and the environment against the imminent and substantial threat that may be present whenever there is a release of a hazardous substance in the environment. We have concerns that House Bill 3349, narrowing lenders' liability, will impede better and faster cleanups of the hazardous substance releases addressed in the state Superfund law. We feel that the proposed exemptions from liability are unnecessary because the existing programs are working, and removal of liability would discourage lenders from making careful loans, placing more of a burden on taxpayers and potentially increasing environmental degradation. My two main points are, first, current provisions adequately protect lenders. The liability provisions of the state Superfund law follow those of the federal program under the federal Superfund, what's called CERCLA, or the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. The federal Superfund contains provisions for strict joint and several liability, and I want to amend my testimony. The state Superfund law follows that in interpretation, and in the actual statute states only strict liability. and I've just been informed of that this afternoon. In September of 1990, the Southern Finance Project, which is a think tank on consumer issues based in North Carolina, studied all potentially responsible parties in EPA's Site Enforcement Tracking System database. This is a publicly available database of all the responsible parties on all federally listed Superfund sites, not just the most hazardous sites that are eligible for federal cleanup money. The SFP study looked for the impacts of the federal Superfund program on lenders. Lenders comprise 40 of the 17,095 total PRPs, principal responsible parties, and that is 0.23%. I got a breakdown that includes the numbers for Region 10, which in EPA includes Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. Lenders comprise 5 of 1,011 PRPs, or 0.49%. All of those 5 are in the state of Washington.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson.
Does that mean then that it wouldn't have much of an effect if we took banks out of the picture, so you're supporting this bill then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no. It means that the concern that lenders have for being tied in as potentially responsible parties for liability is not a very large problem at this time. Okay. I've also just received information out of an EPA study examining internal documents. This is not my testimony. EPA did a similar study and came up with similar numbers. The lenders are not a very large percentage, again, I believe about less than 2% of the total number of PRPs. Both the federal and state Superfund programs include specific exemptions from liability for lenders. Federal law has 2 provisions, 1 exemption for lenders holding only a security interest in the property, and the second exempting lenders who, quote, did not know and had no reason to know that toxic substances had been released at the site. State law parallels both these provisions. Second point is that changes in liability would discourage careful loan policies. Changes in liability would lower the incentive for lenders to make environmentally sound loans. Many lenders are conducting environmental assessments in advance of loans to avoid potential problems. Careful lenders do not need further exemptions from liability. Narrowing liability will shift more of the burden for toxic cleanups to the state's taxpayers as more sites become orphan and cleanups must be funded through state monies. Because of the limited availability of such funds, cleanups could be delayed, resulting in increased environmental degradation and risk to public health.
Chairman. Representative Bryan.
Excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Sugarman. I just had a question on that paragraph, so I wanted to ask it while we're still on it. In making the comment that removal of liability would discourage lenders from making environmentally sound loans. I'm not sure what an environmentally sound loan is, first of all. Secondly, what if a lender responsibly, you know, requires examination of soils, et cetera, before making a loan, then makes the loan, and so the business is out there operating for a period of 3 years, 5 years, whatever. And then it's time for loan renewal, or it's time, let's say, a bankruptcy where the bank takes back the property. Then it's discovered that during that operation period, the property had become had toxic waste or something had become present on the property or in the soils. What about that situation?
In the situation Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, the situation of as the loan is being made, if a lender undergoes an investigation with due diligence, then they are included in the current exemptions. That's the second provision. They did not know and did not have reason to know that there was a problem. You have to talk to another attorney about the second situation about how that would operate.
Here's what I'm saying.
I believe I believe they would not be exempt from liability. But I'm not an attorney.
I guess my concern is for a lender to, I think it doesn't seem quite right that to force the lender into the position of having to supervise the detailed activities of a business. I mean, going out, making judgments on exactly what they're doing and whether they're doing everything properly just because they made them a loan. Or is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, I'm suggesting that lenders should be concerned about the environmentally responsible activities of the people to whom they're lending money, and that the company should operate in an environmentally responsible manner and not contribute to additional creation of toxic waste sites.
Chair, wouldn't that cause them to need to be inspecting their mortgagors
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, perhaps that would.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
I want to buy a piece of property, and it's dirty, not because I made it dirty, but because the person who had it before me did, and the business went under, and there's PCBs all over it now or something. And I go to the bank, and I say, I've got my dream here for what I'm going to do with this property, and I'm going to have to clean the thing up first, and I want a loan. And the bank says, no, sorry, I'm not going to loan you that money. Who benefits from that scenario? I mean, I don't buy the property. Property doesn't get cleaned up unless DEQ comes in and cleans it up. I guess I'm unclear. I'm unclear as to what the universe would look like. But let me back up even further. Your testimony, current provisions adequately protect lenders. Can you go back over that for a minute and explain to me why that's the case from your perspective?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark.
I missed it first time around.
Certainly. The federal law and the state law both have two provisions for lenders. As I said, one for the security interest and the other for the did not know and had no reason to know, which encourages the due diligence investigation beforehand, before making the loan. The concern there is so that the responsible party, the one who did cause the contamination, is indeed responsible for the cleanup of that site.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Narrowing liability will shift more of the burden for toxic cleanups to the state's taxpayers. More sites become orphaned, and cleanups must be funded through state monies. Do you disagree with the statement made by the representatives of the Bankers Association that under the current situation, you're having a lot of people walk away from foreclosures, a lot of people just walk away from the property, and the property becomes orphaned in that way? I mean, doesn't the problem come from both directions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I have not seen enough examples where that has happened, certainly not in Oregon, where that I'm aware of yet, to support the statement of the Bankers Association on that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions?
Well, thank you.
Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, she mentioned that the federal law has two provisions that exempt lenders from liability. Earlier testimony was that those laws have been interpreted by courts to allow liability to take place. Do you agree with that testimony?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I haven't read the cases.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Eggerman? Thank you very much. Where's my witness list? Clark, who else is on the witness list?
What did I do?
Who else is next on the witness list?
Oh, no,
I'm not sure you want to call him.
Mr. Williamson wanted to come back next time around.
Okay, I guess. Any further witnesses on? Okay, Mr. Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. We would like to register our support of this legislation. It's a very important component of dealing with the underground storage tank issue that is so pressing on this state and, in fact, all the states now in complying with the federal regulations. My clients have experienced untold difficulties obtaining financing because of this very issue of lender liability. Right now in the Senate Business, Housing, and Finance Committee, we are working at putting together a comprehensive package that expands on the work that we did in 1989 and the programs we put in place in 1989 to help petroleum marketers obtain financing and have appropriate programs and state assistance that will allow them to not only come in compliance with federal regulations, but to actually get the help they need to clean up these sites and to take care of the existing contamination. The problem that we have is that you have a marketer, the collateral that he can put up is his service stations. Banks won't accept that because they know if those service stations, and all of them are 15, 20 years old, have some degree of contamination there. They don't know how much, but there's a chance that if it involves groundwater, it may very well, and very easily, in fact, outstrip the marketer's ability to meet the financial requirements of that cleanup. And banks are very afraid that if they loan money on that for what they thought was a $15,000 cleanup that turns into a $350,000 cleanup, that they're going to be left holding the bag because they made a loan on it. And in all the work that we've done so far, in fact, the association I represent and the national affiliate back in Washington, D.C., this issue of lender liability is one of our number one important issues, and I simply wanted to come forward and register our support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowe. Questions? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, just one. So I understand that the marketer himself is liable if he has a spill or a leak or whatever. Your clients have to pay for everything essentially they've got to cover that cost.
Right, unless it bankrupts them.
Okay. So I assume that gives them some incentive to be careful and not create spills or whatever.
Very careful.
The question I have for you is, does this additional threat to the lenders that makes it difficult for your clients to get loans, does it cause your clients to be any more cautious about spills than they would be otherwise because of their own liability?
Well, I think that the consciousness, if you will, about this issue has caused marketers of the past 5 years, over the decade of the 80s, to be much more conscientious in their practices in terms of fuel, their inventories in their tanks, sticking their tanks and that kind of thing, because they realize now, in very real terms, the consequences if they're not good stewards of that product that they're storing there. So by and large, yes, it has caused them to be better managers. And this is...
You didn't hear my question.
Yeah.
Their own liability mm-hmm. causes them to be careful about spills.
Right.
To a certain degree, whatever degree that is.
Because mm-hmm.
they know if they have a spill, they're going to pay for it right out of their own pocket.
Right.
My question to you is, does this additional problem that we're trying to deal with here, which is the threat to lenders, and which ends up resulting in making it for your difficult for your clients to get loans, does that problem, this threat to lenders, make them any more careful than they already would be because of their own liability for spills?
I'm not sure I follow the threat of your question, Representative Johnson. It's that they're careful. Yeah, if the bank would be left liable or holding the bag, yes, it would increase to that.
Let me ask you. Your clients are subject to being bankrupt
mm-hmm.
to pay for a spill if it costs that much,
mm-hmm.
right? I would guess that that makes them very careful about spills.
Certainly.
Okay, as careful as they can be,
mm-hmm.
in essence. I don't know how much more careful they can be just because their lender may also have some liability as well as them.
Right.
Your clients are the ones in control, physical control of the
right.
product and whether there's a spill or not.
Right.
They're already as careful as they can be.
Right.
The threat to their lender doesn't make them any more careful, correct?
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Bowe, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Further witnesses? Okay, thank you. We're going to close the public. And I want to inform those who came to testify, both pro and con, that we're going to take a little time and have this back for a hearing in a week or so or 10 days and give the proponents and opponents an opportunity to look the situation over and maybe reach some compromises and come back to us. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3349. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 572. Learned Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 572 deals with financing statements, examples of which you have in your materials. Under current law, a secured party who wants to change something in the financing statement has to get the debtor to sign the amendment. This can create a paperwork nightmare if, for example, as is common these days, a bank changes its name. They've got to hunt down all those debtors and get them to sign the new financing statements. You have in your materials, besides the standard form of financing agreement so that you can see what we're dealing with, a copy of the unanimous Senate vote on this bill.
Thank you, Learned Counsel. Mr. Bronner, just kind of poof, and you appear. It's nice to have you out again.
It's good to be here, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you sally forth there and give us your perspective on Senate
Mr. Bill Chair, members of the committee, Frank Bronner, the Oregon Bankers Association, you've had the bill explained to you. In these days of mergers, acquisitions, it's not an infrequent occasion for a creditor to change its name and or address sometimes two, three times, and in the case of Bank of America, they went through the process four times. It's a part of a complicated transaction. The bill provides that, the bill is reflective of our the times we live in. It will greatly ease the burden of amendment of financing statements where the only change is the name or the address of the secured party. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Mr. Bronner, do you or Mr. Fordyce, who seems to be waiting in the wings but not having the courage to come before us, have any amendments to this bill since the Senate passed it with only one vote not in favor, and that was because he was excused from most likely for business or medical, whatever? Any amendments?
Mr. Chair, we think it's a perfect bill.
Perfect bill. Perfect. Is that a 10?
That's a 10.
That's a 10.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
You might get perfect marks for performance, but the degree of difficulty, not,
not quite there.
I think, Mr. Chair, that Representative Clark makes a good point. It's probably not a 10. It's probably a 4.5.
Okay. All right. Well, we want to clarify that because we haven't had many 10s in this committee. So we don't have any members that are. So moving right along.
We don't have a quorum, do we?
We don't have a quorum, but I'm going to ask if there's any further witnesses on Senate Bill 572 before we proceed to open up the work session.
We need one.
Nice. So why don't we go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill?
Can't. We don't have a quorum.
We just have to wait for them to show, though, right?
Right.
We'll be in temporary suspended animation here.
Motion placed and wait till someone walks in the door.
Go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 572.
Mr. Chair, I move
which allows, okay, go ahead.
572 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Clark's moved Senate Bill 572 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Clark, why don't you just kind of brief those members who may be distracted temporarily for exactly what the bill does. I want me to do that.
No, Mr. Chair, I'll be glad to do that. Representative Edmondson, this bill allows the secured party to amend a financing statement without the debtor's address when the secured party changes the secured party's address.
Does that include post office boxes?
Right.
Yes.
This bill passed the Senate on a vote of 29 with one abstention. Absent. Excused.
I think that statement is supposed to help.
I hope. But then again,
what
makes you think they read these bills?
Well, I've been concerned.
Okay. Well, we just want to put that on the record.
Go ahead and give you a courtesy vote on this one.
Okay. Well, we just keep certain people out the relating clause. We're in good shape. Representative Bell, do you have any deep feelings on this one? Deep feelings? Okay. It's fine. Representative Bryan, are we okay? Is the Bulldog feel comfortable with this piece of meat?
I'd be most happy to chew on this in a while, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Would you do you want to keep it around or do you want to move it forward?
Let's move it to a full position.
Okay. And Representative Clark has already moved that. Clerk will please call the roll. Caught him off guard.
Representative Bryan?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Edmondson?
Yes.
Struggle.
Johnson?
Aye.
Mannix? Miller? Bell?
Aye.
Chair Baum?
Votes yes. Senate Bill 572, having received the appropriate majority, is forwarded to the full committee to do pass recommendation. Go ahead and close the public hearing. And we'll ask Representative Johnson to carry that bill. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Go ahead and close the public hearing, work session on Senate Bill 572, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 426, revises non-corporation profit law for trade schools.
Bad joke, Mr. Chair.
Staff, you want to briefly get into this one? And then we'll have the, we have a list of, we have three sheets of witnesses.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Would you like me to?
We'll bring up Mr. Wolfstein to come on up here and sit while you explain. And we bring anybody else, right? You're welcome to. Anybody else wants to come up and sit down there? They've got three chairs.
Well, we've seen this before, haven't we?
We have.
And learned and most.
Why?
Expert counsel will go ahead and bring us up to speed so you know where you are today.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 426 was before the committee once before. It makes revision to the Nonprofit Corporation Act that was passed during the last session. When the bill was last before the committee, there was no proponent to explain the one provision that provided the stumbling block to passing it out the last time, which was the provision of loans to directors and officers as part of a recruitment package. You have in your materials a section-by-section analysis of the bill, as well as a proposed housekeeping amendment. Representative Clark wanted to discuss with the proponents of the bill the need for the recruitment package, and that's why the bill is back.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, it's just been a while since we've seen this bill.
So that time Shelley forth a little bit.
Yeah, I guess I just...
Why don't you go
my
ahead?
Recollection was that, and Council, my recollection was that the committee was kind of comfortable with most of the parts of the bill except the loan. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's correct.
So where's the explanation for that then here in the materials?
Right in front of you.
Oh, very human explanation. Okay.
Mr. is it Wolfstone?
Mr. Chair, my name is Carl Myers. I'm a Salem attorney. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, and my sole purpose in being here is to introduce to you the two gentlemen that are sitting with me at the table, who can answer the questions of the committee specifically in regards to the loans and the recruitment section. Mr. Jeff Wolfstone is a member of the business law.